Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts in the Bay Area. I'm Rose Aguilar, sitting in this week for David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with artistic director Bill English of the San Francisco Playhouse about The Effect, a play by British playwright Lucy Prebble. The Effect is a funny and moving exploration of love, depression, and the limitations of neuroscience in our current pill-popping culture. And then we'll speak with Timothy Zelig, artistic director and conductor of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, and chorus member Clint Johnson about Bridges, an evening of music that was inspired by the Lavender Pen Tour, last year's week-long concert through the Deep South. And later in the show, we'll talk about the concert A Listening Quilt, contemporary chamber music by women composers from North and South America. A Listening Quilt celebrates a culturally diverse harvest of music by female composers from the United States, Mexico, Cuba, and Argentina. We'll have four incredible musicians in studio performing for you on Open Air. And kicking off the show today is Bill English. Bill is artistic director and co-founder of the San Francisco Playhouse. Over the course of 14 years, Bill English and co-founder Susie Damilano have guided its growth from a bare-bones storefront to the second largest theater in San Francisco. Bill is director of The Effect, a play that takes on our pill-popping culture with humor and drama. The Effect runs through April 28th at the SF Playhouse in downtown San Francisco, 450 Post Street between Mason and Powell Streets. Hi, Bill. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. This play, The Effect, has received rave reviews. It's been shown in many cities. When did you first learn about it?
I first read the London reviews. You know, it was at the National Theater. And then it was at the Barrow Street Theater in New York and reviewed very, very well by the London press and the New York press. And I was just really intrigued by the story, and I wouldn't say it's fair to say it's about the pill-popping culture of kind of people out there that take pills to get through the day and uppers and downers and that kind of thing. It's really about a drug trial in a pharmaceutical company is testing a new drug for depression, and it's about some of the people who take part in the trial as volunteers.
This was an actual drug trial?
It's an actual drug trial as we put on our stage in theatrical form.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is an actual drug trial. Lucy got the idea from a news item in England. I think it was called the Elephant Drug trial, the Elephant Man drug trial, because there were some horrific side effects. They had some men in the drug trial that had some of their fingers and toes fall off, and they had organ failure. It was a huge scandal. And she read about it, and she was obviously appalled, but also intrigued by the theatrical power of a drug trial in terms of putting people in this arena, this kind of petri dish, and watching their reactions, which is, of course, what we do when we go to the theater.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the humans who agree to this drug trial.
Well, there's a bunch of them in the trial, but this one focuses on two people. It's a young man who's done a bunch of drug trials and kind of does it for the money and is kind of a roustabout, kind of vagabond-type character from the South, and a young woman who's a psychology student at college, and she's doing it because it's, you know, something she wants to learn about. And they are the two primary characters in the play. The other characters, of course, are the two doctors who are running the trial.
What was it like for you to work on this play while we are having this opioid crisis in this country?
Well, it certainly wasn't picked to reflect the opioid crisis. And it's not specifically aimed at it, but there definitely is an element in the play about the pharmaceutical company's motives in terms of primarily wanting to get a product to market that they can make money on. And in the play, they sometimes look past evidence that they might should have shut the trial down in the interests of profit.
And it also looks at, as humans, our relationship to drugs and how it affects us and our emotions.
I think so. It's more, in that sense, it's more about how we medicate ourselves for depression. This particular trial is testing on a new drug that's been invented to combat depression, but they're testing it on people who are normal for side effects. They want to see what the physical side effects are. And so it's kind of about, it's actually not even about depression, but the element that is should we medicate for depression?
Hmm.
Does it work? Are there other avenues people can pursue, whether it's meditation or mindfulness or exercise or just the discipline of self-study that can relieve depression? All of these answers, of course, are true, you know, and there's some situations where medication is important and some where it probably wouldn't be a good idea.
Bill English is director of The Effect. It runs through April 28th at the San Francisco Playhouse in downtown San Francisco, 450 Post Street between Mason and Powell. This play was written by Lucy Preble, and you can find more information at kalw.org. There's also a love element to the play.
Well, yes. It basically is a love story. The couple, although they're not a couple, when they get on this drug, it stimulates their dopamine levels to an extraordinary degree, and they find themselves falling absolutely deeply, deeply in love, and they're crazed for each other, and they're sneaking off into the bushes. But they're also almost immediately tormented, particularly the girl, with not knowing whether they are both on the drug, whether one of them is on the drug and one of them is on a placebo, and which that might be.
Mm.
So see, what the wonderful thing about the play is, I think that keys into something mythological and universal, is that do we really understand our own feelings? And can we trust our feelings in this tumult of information that descends upon us and drugs? So it's the struggle to understand whether they're actually in love or whether they are being influenced, one of them possibly, by this drug. And that's what the drama really revolves around.
Hmm. What is the process involved in bringing a play like The Effect to the San Francisco Playhouse? When you learn there's so many plays out there right now, how do you choose? What was it about this one that made you want to direct it?
That very thing I just said, that I think it poses an eternal human dilemma about trusting our more outrageous emotions. You know, are we in love? Are we not in love? Are we furious and want to take physical action against someone? Or should we just take a step back and look at our emotions? It's difficult for us to manage them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this play puts that process on the stage for us to look at and maybe learn more about ourselves, or learn that we need to take a little step back from emotions to kind of understand what may be driving us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a story. Whenever you put people between a rock and a hard place, you know, I think that's where great drama is born. When people have a difficult choice to make and they don't know which way to go, you find the great plays of all time are generally doing that. And so whenever I see a play that does that, bingo, I want to present it because I like that kind of situation.
Over the course of 14 years, you and co-founder Susie DeMilano have really grown the San Francisco Playhouse. When you think about where we are today with so much technology and our political situation, talk a little bit about how things have changed for you over the course of those 14 years.
Well, we've grown a lot. We started out in a little storefront, you know, nowhere place with 30 people and 20 people and 50 people. And now we have a theater that will seat up to 300, and we fill the house fairly regularly. And I think we have successfully found a niche with people that really like to be in an intimate relationship to challenging stories, stories that make them think, stories that challenge their suppositions, stories that can be sometimes a little disturbing.
Mm.
But they're provocative. And being in that intimate connection to those stories, I think, really forces people to engage. Like our nickname is the Empathy Gym, because we feel that people go to the theater and always have to practice their powers of compassion. It's a laboratory, if you will, where people are confronted with a symbolic human being who they can identify with more safely than, say, somebody on the street. So because it's that safe laboratory, people are free to kind of work out their ability to have compassion. And that's, of course, why we think that theater is a community-building event. You know, it's the oldest art form, and its purpose has never changed. Mm. And it's, so it's kind of, I think theater is kind of the perfect antidote to technology, because you're right there, and the actor is right there, a few feet from you, and you are forced to engage with her, and you're going to be transformed by that experience. There's no getting out of it. So,
and you are turning off your technology for those few hours. At least that's the hope.
Exactly. Exactly. You go analog with all of us into an absolutely public thing. I've wanted to do this for a long time, and I did it for the first time last night. I said, well, here we are. We're all strangers. And yet, like, to the people, we're a community. And why don't we all just, like my minister used to do in church, why don't you just turn to the person next to you and say hi, mm-hmm. because we're going to all go on this ride together. And I think everybody kind of enjoyed it. It's the first time I've ever tried that.
Why has it taken so long?
I don't know. I'm a little afraid that it'll be associated with, like, religious stuff, you know, which we're not. You know, we're non-denominational.
Non-denominational theater.
So, but it works so well, I'm probably going to get in the habit of doing it, because it makes people feel like they are, this group of people here is a community.
I always enjoy that, actually, when someone says, say hi to the person next to you or the person behind you. Just acknowledge their presence.
Yeah, so we won't just be totally anonymous.
I love that you use the word compassion, though, because when you go to theater, you in some ways put yourself in someone else's shoes.
Correct.
And learn things about places that you've never been or maybe dreamt about, or in this case, watch volunteers in a clinical trial for a new super antidepressant. Right? So can you talk more about that, about the compassion part of theater? And as a director, is this something you think about, or how do you think about it when you're putting plays on?
I think about it constantly in the choice of the play, making sure what we want to do is anything that'll pull the audience out. We want to get people immersed in it and keep them there. So our scenic work is always very, very strong to pull people in. And with the actors we choose to work with are people who work very close to themselves, so they're very, there's not a lot of theatricality in it, you know, so that we make it as easy as possible for people to identify with the character. And then obviously picking stories, you know, which have characters we feel will compel the audience's identification, you know, and you work through empathy. Empathy is the act of getting in the other person's shoes. Mm-hmm. Compassion is you take a step back afterwards and go, wow, I never imagined that I could be in that person's shoes. The next time I meet someone like that, I'm going to have a little more compassion for them.
Mm. Bill English is director of the play Effect. It was winner of the UK Critics Circle Award for Best New Play. Connie and Tristan are falling head over heels in love, or is it that just a side effect? As volunteers in a clinical trial for a new super antidepressant, they really can't be sure. As their sudden romance heats up, they're left wondering if they can believe their own feelings, and their doctors are forced to consider the ethical consequences of their work. The Effect runs through April 28th at the San Francisco Playhouse in downtown San Francisco, 450 Post Street. I also want to ask you, Bill, since you've been at the San Francisco Playhouse for 14 years and have built it up to become the second largest theater in San Francisco, because we have access to so much information now and things are they're just thrown at us, I always like to sit back and think about how much time has gone into this performance, the lighting, the costumes, the people who don't really get applause, the volunteers. Just so much goes into putting on a performance.
It's a pretty huge deal. I mean, you start planning the show almost a year before it actually occurs. You know, you start with the casting process, and the set design process takes a very long time. And so those two processes kind of move along together, you know, and then we have a shop with three carpenters, employees that build the sets, and we have a costumer, and we have a lighting designer, and a props designer, and a sound designer, and a video designer, and two backstage managers who actually serve also as attendants on the set. And they're just amazing. And they are the people, in my mind, at the moment, that deserve the most thanks.
Dedicated people.
Yeah, dedicated. And then you've got all the people in the office and the front of staff and the front of house and the stage managers. And, you know, it's 30 or 40, 50 people involved in every show.
Wow. You have a couple other exciting plays coming up.
Yes, our next play is going to be The Entomologist's Love Story, which is a world premiere by Melissa Ross, and we're really excited about that. It's about a couple of young entomologists who work at the Natural History Museum in New York City, and they're very successful, sort of in their mid-30s, and they used to be a couple, and they now still are kind of attached and live together, but they're no longer a couple. So they're trying to work out how they go about detaching. So it's about the mating rituals of humans who are studying the mating rituals of insects.
I love that. And that's May 8th through June 23rd. And then another one in
Sunday in the Park with George. Oh, in Brownell.
Yeah.
In Brownell is another world premiere in our Sandbox series. And it's a brand new play, and it'll be getting its first wings and first test flight in our Sandbox series at the Roof Theater at ACT Strand. In June, I think.
And that one sounds great. It's an American couple, Justin and Sarah, are reeling after the election, and they decide to take their outrage to another place, the little-known city of Braunau in Austria.
Birthplace of Adolf Hitler.
And that one runs from June 13th to July 7th.
Correct. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Bill. Thank you for bringing these plays to San Francisco.
Thank you. It's been so much fun talking to you.
You too. Thank you. Bill English is director of The Effect. It is a play that takes on, well, it's a drug test. We won't say that it takes on our pill-popping culture with humor and drama, and it runs through April 28th at the San Francisco Playhouse in downtown San Francisco. Bill English, artistic director, and co-founder Susie Damolano have guided its growth from a bare-bones storefront to the second largest theater in San Francisco. Thanks for coming in, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up after a short break, we will be speaking with Dr. Timothy Zielig, artistic director and conductor of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, and Clint Johnson, long-term chorus member. This is Open Air. I'm Rose Aguilar, sitting in for David LaTulipe, and we'll be back right after this.
Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week. Pills to walk, pills to think, pills, pills, pills for the family. I spend a year suspended in air, my mind on the gap, my head on the stairs, from healer to dealers, and then back again, from guru to voodoo, and voodoo to zen. Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week. Pills to walk, pills to think, pills, pills, pills for the family. Pills to grow, pills to shrink, pills, pills, pills in a good stiff drink. Pills to f***, pills to eat, pills, pills, pills down the kitchen sink. I'm behind the wheel, I'm leaving your stage. I can't even swim in these waves I made. From the bath to the drain, and the plane to the stage, to the bed, to the head, to the money I made. Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week. Pills to walk, pills to think, pills, pills, pills for the family. Pills to grow, pills to shrink, pills, pills, pills in a good stiff drink. Pills to f***, pills to eat, pills, pills, pills down the kitchen sink.
This is Open Air. I'm Rose Aguilar, sitting in for David LaTulipe. He will be back next week. Now I would like to welcome Dr. Tim Zielig to the show. Tim is artistic director and conductor of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Tim, thank you for coming
in.
Thank
you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Clint Johnson, a long-term chorus member. Hi, Clint. Thank you for coming in.
Certainly.
Tim and Clint are here to talk about Bridges, an evening of music that was inspired by the Lavender Pen Tour, last year's week-long concert through the Deep South. It'll be presented in cooperation with the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir on Thursday, March 29th at 8 p.m. at the Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco. Bridges is inspired by the Lavender Pen Tour. Really, this was such an amazing undertaking.
Well, you should have been with us.
I wish I would have, because it would have been great to do interviews. You traveled through the Deep South and you made 23 appearances in 9 churches and 5 states. Where did this idea come from, Tim?
Well, we did 23 appearances in concert halls, high schools, colleges, churches, everywhere, city parks. We sang everywhere. It started 2 days after the election in 2016. When we were about to celebrate our 40th season, which we are in the middle of right now, and we decided that we were going to go on a foreign tour, maybe in China, possibly Cuba. And 2 days after the election, we said, let's don't spend our money and energy going that far. Let's go to the South, where our brothers and sisters are really suffering. And so we decided we would choose the worst states as far as legislation is concerned. Mm. And that was easy, Mississippi and North Carolina. Mm. And we decided we would go there. And then we filled in with Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And 300 people traveled. Yeah, about 900 pieces of luggage.
Amazing. Yeah. Clint, when you were all talking about this, yeah, tell us about the conversations you were all having.
There was a lot of concern, you know, about, you know, we were walking into what seemed like hostile territory. Mm. And so we kind of had to prepare ourselves for what we might expect and confront our own fears so that we could rise to the occasion and do what we had intended to do. And so there was a lot of conversation around what we might face, what we probably wouldn't face, and what we were really there to do so that we'd arrive focused and ready to get to work.
What were your maybe ideas? What was going through your head before you took off on this trip? Just because we all have stereotypes and opinions about, quote, those places, right? What did you have, Tim?
Did
you grow up?
I grew up in Texas.
Okay.
So, boy, do I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know those people because I am one. So I wasn't afraid. I knew that was not really going to happen, although we had lots of security. And there's a lot of fear because of the stereotypes. Mm. And we found, I can say to a person, we found that that was not the truth. Yeah. We were there with one goal, and that was to uplift and encourage and spread some love to the LGBT community and give them courage to try and change their laws. And we knew that we had to go to the churches if we were going to effect change in the legislature. So we did that, and at every stop, we had people literally coming out of the woodwork that had never seen that many gays. It was awesome. And had never been in a room in a concert hall with 2,000 people that were supporting an LGBT choir. So that was really exciting. And I think all of our fears were allayed, and our thoughts changed, the people who are not from the South, who had never been there. We did have protesters. We did have bomb threats. We did have what you would expect, but none of it came to fruition. We had an incredible team. In every city, we had lots of security. So it came off beautifully, and our goal was accomplished and more.
Mm. Clint, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York.
Okay. So what were your opinions of the South? Did you know much about the places you were visiting?
Not really. I'd never been to the Deep South before. My thoughts really were more about, you know, I wasn't concerned that we weren't going to get a warm reception from the people that we were there to see. But it's been a long time. You know, we live in a bubble in San Francisco, so we are generally accepted very well wherever we go. And it was, my concern was more about what might we face in terms of resistance. I know that the crowds that come to see us are going to be incredibly enthusiastic, not only because what we do well, but because what we were going there to do was so needed. You know, they were really waiting for us to arrive. But we really haven't had to face strong public resistance right in our face, mm-hmm. because we are so well known and so well respected at home.
Dallas, Texas is home to the largest LGBTQ church in the world.
It is. I worked for it.
You did?
I did.
Oh, it's a beautiful church.
Cathedral of Hope.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, there's vibrant, obviously, gay communities all across the country. Some are a little more loud and proud than others. But can you tell us about any surprises that you came across? What stands out for you?
So what we also chose five beneficiaries in each of the five states, and these were organizations from aid services to trans awareness across the board, five in each of the states. And everything that we raised from ticket money went to these beneficiaries, and we left them $100,000 for these organizations. And I think what really stuck with us was these are two volunteers that run Transcendence in North Carolina and take care of all of the transgender people in the whole state and their volunteers. And we are so spoiled here to have the services that we have. Mm-hmm. So these are people who have also chosen to stay in the Deep South to make a difference. Many, many, many have fled mm-hmm. to big cities and to the coasts. And these people have said, no, I'm going to stay here in my home and make a difference. And it is such courage in the face of overwhelming adversity.
Mm. Clint, what were some of your memorable moments?
My memorable moments really did center around, largely around the courage that I saw in the communities. excuse me. I've been with the chorus forever. And
how long, Clint?
About 30 years.
Wow.
And yes. And I have been through that period when, you know, there were not a lot of supporters out there. And I know how hard that is. And with the political climate changing as it is and the obstacles that the people in the South are facing, the gay community in the South is facing, I was really impressed at their willingness to stay and fully face what they had to do mm-hmm. and claim the space that was rightfully theirs. I mean, it was inspiring because I don't have to work that hard to claim the space that I own. Mm. So it was educational, it was uplifting, and it reaffirmed the importance of what we do because people in those places need support.
Clint Johnson is a longtime chorus member, 30 years now, with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Dr. Tim Selig is artistic director and conductor of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And Bridges is an evening of music that was inspired by the Lavender Pen Tour, last year's week-long concert through the Deep South. And it'll be presented in cooperation with the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir on Thursday, March 29th at 8 p.m. at the Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco. Find information at kalw.org. I loved learning that the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus' first ever public performance was at the Candlelight Vigil Morning, Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk after their assassination in 1978. And the Lavender Pen Tour is named in honor of the lavender pen that Harvey Milk gave to Mayor Moscone. Tell us about that history, Tim.
Well, so when we were focused in on the tour and trying to think of a name, you know, the love bubble hits the South, or mine was, I had a favorite, and that was Priscilla Meets Dixie, but no one was really interested in that one. So the name was hard, and we were sitting around, and we thought about, we want to encourage them to have courage to change the legislation, and then Harvey Milk is our patron saint, obviously. Mm. We like to say that he passed the lavender pen off to a baton to the chorus. And so we came up, somebody around our staff meeting just said, what about Harvey's lavender pen? And it really took for us. It's kind of interesting because people don't know that story really well.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing. It's kind of an icon for us. So that performance, how it ties in a bit to Bridges, Holly Neer, singer, activist, songwriter, was on her way to the Candlelight Vigil because she'd been asked to sing something. She wrote a song on a napkin in the cab on the way, and there's this brand new 4-week-old chorus standing there, I'm sure looking deer in headlights, like, what are we going to do? She has this song. She teaches it to everyone backed by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And we're going to do that next week with Holly Neer.
It's so cool. And it comes full circle because we just got word that a terminal at the San Francisco International Airport will be renamed after Harvey Milk.
Yes.
Awesome.
Right?
Yes,
That's just happening. Yeah. Let's talk about Bridges. This is one night of music. And on the program is the California premiere of Seven Last Words of the Unarmed by Joel Thompson. This is a monumental choral work that honors the last words of seven unarmed African-American men killed in recent years. Clint, tell us about this. It sounds so powerful. And we're going to hear a few of the pieces.
It is. It is a very powerful piece of music. It speaks to one of the themes that runs through a lot of what we do, which is really shining a light on the costs and consequences of living in a society that allows people to treat others as less than human. And it does what we often do in our performances for the gay community around civil justice and you know, attaining civil rights. It does that same thing from the perspective of the black community in one slice of the black, you know, the black experience. It's really quite powerful and illuminating. It takes you right to the moment when the individual's humanity is most necessary but is overlooked. So you don't have a chance to layer on your expectations and your perceptions before you first have to deal with the humanity that was lost.
Mm. Let's hear a clip. We'll cue up the clip of Michael Brown, but throughout the evening we'll hear about Kenneth Chamberlain 16, Why Do You Have Your Guns Out, 66, Trayvon Martin 16, What Are You Following Me For, Amadou Diallo 23, Mom, I'm Going to College. Here's a clip, Michael Brown 18, I Don't Have a Gun, Stop Shooting. Michael Brown, 18, I Don't Have a Gun, Stop Shooting. The premiere of Seven Last Words of the Unarmed by Joel Thompson will be performed at Bridges Thursday, March 29th at 8 p.m. at the Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco by members of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And today we're joined by Dr. Tim Seelig, Artistic Director. Clint Johnson has been with the group for 30 years. Clint, what was it like to sing Stop Shooting, I Don't Have a Gun over and over again?
It's hard. It's hard. As a black man, it touches very, very close to home. You wake up every day and you live with the reality that that could very well be you. And to perform the piece well and to really get the message across, you have to be willing to go to that very dark and scary place. So as a singer, it's really hard. But at the same time, it is, you know, Joel Thompson did an incredible job of providing a vehicle to express the frustration and the fear, all of the feelings that come with that moment. So it is cathartic in a way, but to have the catharsis, you have to look these demons in the face. And that can be a lot of work.
On Thursday, March 29th at the Davies Symphony Hall, this is going to be the California premiere of this piece. Mm-hmm. Will the family members of any of these men be there?
They will not. So Joel Thompson, the composer, will be, but not any of the family members.
That would be really powerful. I mean, will you perform it again in the future?
We will. The choruses that have performed it, it began with the Michigan State Glee Club. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry? The Michigan Glee Club. Oh, my gosh. At the wrong school. Sorry, people. It started in Michigan Glee Club, and it has been performed now by the Gay Men's Choruses in Cincinnati and in Portland and in Minneapolis next week, and it's starting to really take hold. It's fascinating that the Gay Men's Choruses are embracing this, exactly what Clint so beautifully said, It's part of what we do, mm. is we shine a light on injustice and inequality, not just where it pertains to us, but where it pertains to others. It's mm. our mission.
Can we cue up the Oscar Grant clip? Also in the premiere of Seven Last Words of the Unarmed, you'll hear from Eric Garner, 43, I Can't Breathe, John Crawford, 22, It's Not Real, and here is Oscar Grant, 22, You Shot Me, You Shot Me.
You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me. You shot me.
Is from Seven Last Words of the Unarmed by Joel Thompson, a choral work that honors the last words of seven unarmed African-American men killed in recent years. That clip is from the Oscar Grant piece, 22, You Shot Me, You Shot Me. This is going to be performed with Bridges Thursday, March 29th at 8 p.m. at the Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco. Today we're joined by Dr. Tim Selig, Artistic Director and Conductor of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, and Clint Johnson, longtime chorus member. So powerful.
It takes your breath away.
It really does.
I would just say that what Joel has done, which is so beautiful, he wrote this piece not for anybody. He wrote this because he needed to write it. He was so moved by these experiences. And he makes no comment. There's no commentary here. There's no, this is how you should feel or what you should think. It's not about police. It's not about, it's no comment. It just brings to light these seven men and their lives lost. It is one of the most powerful things I've ever conducted.
Can you talk more about that?
Sure. It's a challenge to bring a piece like this to the chorus. We've mm-hmm. done many things. We sang throughout the AIDS pandemic. So we've sung difficult. We've sung in difficult for hundreds of memorial services. So we've been in that space before. But this one takes us out of our own experience, except, of course, for Clint and the other African-American singers who live with this on a daily basis. We're putting ourselves in someone else's shoes. Mm-hmm. The preparation is, it's a push and pull between just learning the notes, learn the rhythms, take yourself out of this text, don't think about what it's saying, and then at the next rehearsal, okay, now I need you to feel, because we don't want to just sing the notes. But I when Clint said it's been cathartic, I'm like, not yet it has. I'm waiting any moment for that catharsis.
Well, it's a wave.
Because it's still so hard. It's so hard. And that's what art is.
And you can add names. That's the other thing. There was a man that was shot in Sacramento in his own backyard for holding a cell phone.
Yeah.
And the list, it just continues to grow.
Yeah, and it is... It's a subject that we don't discuss honestly. Mm. And it's very difficult to clean up something that you refuse to look at or touch. And this is our effort at participating in that cleanup. You know, we understand what it is to live at that intersection. so we want to be allies. We want to use our voice in places that where we will be heard, where it's quite possible, you know, black people or other people who are telling the same story might not have access. They might not be seen. They might not be heard. But we have access. We will be seen. We will be heard. So we can step in and tell that story on their behalf.
Well, I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Oh, Clint Johnson is a longtime chorus member with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. 30 years.
Yes.
Did you start when you were 10? one other question. How has your voice changed over those 30 years?
Surprisingly, I've been a second tenor my entire life.
Really?
Yeah.
And how do you keep it? I always wonder this. People who sing a lot, do you do exercises for your voice regularly? Or
it's not so much doing exercises, but being mindful of good technique, resting when necessary.
Resting.
Not over-singing. and really just kind of staying focused, in your craft so that you can, stick in there for the long haul.
Clint is singing the solo on Amadou Diallo.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Who, in his last moments, his thought process said, "Mom, I'm going to college."
Wow.
And he gets to sing those words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clint Johnson, longtime chorus member with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Dr. Tim Selig is artistic director and conductor of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Bridges is inspired by the Lavender Pen Tour, last year's concert tour in the Deep South. They made 23 appearances in 9 churches and 5 states. And you will also see the California premiere, or listen to and see, the California premiere of 7 Last Words of the Unarmed by Joel Thompson, a monumental choral work that honors the last words of 7 unarmed African-American men killed in recent years. You can see this Thursday, March 29th at 8 o'clock at the Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco. Clint and Tim, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about a listening quilt, contemporary chamber music by women composers from North and South America. This is Open Air. I'm Rose Aguilar, sitting in for David LaTulipe this week. We'll be back after this.
Play that thing, jazz band. Play it for the lords and ladies, for the dukes and counts, for the whores and gigolos, for the American millionaires and the school teachers out for a spree. Play it, jazz band. You know that tune that laughs and cries at the same time? You know it. May I? Mais oui. Mein Gott! Parece una rumba. Play it, jazz band. You've got 7 languages to speak in and then some. Even if you do come from Georgia, can I go home with you, sweetie?
Thank you.
beautiful. You have been listening to flutist Martha Rodriguez Salazar, clarinetist Rachel Condrey, pianist Jennifer Peringer, there with the chamber music ensemble, the Bernal Hill Players, and cellist Jill Brendel. And they are here in the KALW studios to play some beautiful music today and to talk about their upcoming concert, A Listening Quilt, contemporary chamber music by women composers from North and South America. It'll be performed on Sunday, March 25th at 4 p.m. at the Community Music Center in San Francisco, 544 Cap Street. It celebrates a culturally diverse harvest of music by female composers from the United States, Mexico, Cuba, and Argentina. Thank you so much. That was so beautiful. Thank you all for coming in studio. It's such a treat to have musicians in studio. You know what I'd love to talk about first is the piece, A Listening Quilt, a contemporary chamber music by women composers. Who came up with this idea? Where'd this come from?
The three of us were I'm new to the group, and the group's been around.
Can you say your name?
Yeah, I'm Rachel Condrey.
Thank you.
And I joined Jennifer and Marta about a year ago, and we were just talking about ways to reinvent ourselves, and I think this concert represents a cross-section, I think, for all of us of, like, what our personal interests are as musicians and humans, And we were talking about women, like how. In fact, we were examining how to talk about women as composers without calling them women composers, really. Because I'm personally a student of Pauline Oliveros, and she, of course, wrote a very famous New York Times op-ed in 1970. Don't call them lady composers, which we were discussing at the time, and trying to think about ways that we could talk about women. Women's music without, like, making... Anyway, so the quilt idea came up because that's sort of historically a women's craft, and we are also melding together all these different voices. And
why, can I ask, why can't we call them women composers? Well, what's the argument behind that?
So her argument at the time was that, you know, it was being used as a derogatory to separate women composers from composers in general. Of course, her argument was these are composers, and whether they're women or not is irrelevant. And so, but our take is more, I think these days it's more about the importance of listening and listening to voices that have been historically not heard as loudly or heard at all. And that's where, you know, our interest is in bringing this music out into the world.
Tell us about the next piece you'd like to play.
Oh, I guess that's me. I'm Jill Brendel.
Hi, Jill.
Hi. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Claudia Montero, who is an award-winning composer, up-and-coming composer, I would call her. She's from Argentina. And, of course, when you think of Argentina, you think of the tango. And the great appealing thing about the tango is its combination of pleasure and pain, longing, you know, kind of like bittersweet chocolate. And and that's what you get from this little piece we're going to play, Buenos Aires en Tres. I should mention that she's performed all over the world. She's got an upcoming project with the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra. She's also gotten awards, two Latin Grammy Awards in the category of Best Classical Contemporary Composition, not Best Classical Contemporary Woman's Composition, and also for her concerto for violin and string orchestra. And here it is.
Thank you.
beautiful. Cellist Jill Brendel, flutist Martha Rodriguez-Salazar, clarinetist Rachel Condry, and pianist Jennifer Perringer. They will be performing a concert, a listening quilt, contemporary chamber music by women composers from North and South America at 4 p.m. on Sunday, March 25th at the Community Music Center in San Francisco, 544 Cap Street. And this celebrates a culturally diverse harvest of music by women composers, I said it, from the U.S., Mexico, Cuba, and Argentina. Oh, and it's free. Fantastic. Free. Okay, I know we don't like to say women composers, but I can't think of an alternative. So can you tell us about how hard is it to find these women? Because if you go to a talk about classical music or watch a documentary about classical music, inevitably it's about a white male composer.
That's
right, and the names. If you ask someone on the street, can you name a composer? Inevitably, it would be probably a white man.
Absolutely, and that's always been a big agenda of mine because I grew up not having any idea that I could compose. You know that it was possible. You know, all the pieces I grew up playing were by dead European white men, and so it's always been a big priority for me as a musician to celebrate diversity and to try to make sure that we included in our programs pieces by women composers. Mm. And so now we're devoting a whole program to it, and it was tricky to find. We wanted to do North American and South American composers, and it was much easier to find the North American composers. They had a more prominent visibility on the internet. It was much harder to find the Latin American composers. And it made me realize the importance of some of these organizations that some of these composers have created to promote women's work, because it created much more visibility online. And I just, it was really a struggle to find the women composers, but we stuck at it, and I think we found a wonderfully diverse program. Mm. And I'm excited about it.
And that is pianist Jennifer Perringer. Martha Rodriguez-Salazar, can we bring the mic over to Martha? What would you add to that, Martha, when you're talking about highlighting, learning about playing music from women composers?
Well, for me, it is also very important to acknowledge the fact that when I was studying in Mexico, I'm from Mexico, I really barely, you know, ever performed a piece by a women composer.
Wow.
But I made a point back then to make my thesis about, you know, new compositions, and I particularly asked for two women to be there at least. Mm. And that brought us an idea as well when Jennifer and I started the group a couple of years ago. And we wanted to do this bridge between Mexico and the United States, me being Mexican, Jennifer being from here. And so we started commissioning pieces from Bay Area composers, but also we commissioned pieces from a very, very interesting woman composer, Gabriela Ortiz, which we're going to be playing her piece. And we have a little excerpt of her. She's a very prominent composer. She's all over the world now. She's studying in my same school, the National School of Music in the UNAM. And she wrote a piece that, for us, we commissioned her a piece, and she wrote a piece that has to do with a very, very feisty neighborhood in Mexico City. It's a neighborhood that you don't really want to go, unless you want to, like, you know, go there with your, I don't know, like a bunch of people, and you might want to go get a watch or a radio. I mean, they have all these kind of underground markets there. And it's called Tepito. And that's the piece we're going to be doing. But, I mean, for me, I felt so proud that there was some, you know, composers from Mexico that really wanted to put into what's going on in Mexico right now.
In music schools today, what are people learning? Are they learning more about women composers?
That's a good question. Do you know?
I don't know. It's been a while since I was. I hope so.
Yeah.
I can say that we're playing a piece by Libby Larson, who's an American composer, and I worked with her when I was in college and played some of her solo work at that time. But that was partly because I had a female teacher who was premiering her work at the mm-hmm. time. So it's a lot of, you know, and actually the first piece we played, Valerie Coleman, is the founder of Imani Winds, and I have some friends who are in that group, and so like I knew of them and knew of her and her compositions, and then I stumbled across this new work for our that would work for our ensemble. So anyway, it's I think yes, it is happening more, but
we have time for one more piece.
Great.
Is this the one with Gabrielle Ortiz?
Yes, we're okay. Going to be playing an excerpt of two movements. One is called Calzado Pachuco, which is this fancy shoes that people wear in Mexico to dance danzón. And the other one is Gimnasio Gloria, where fighters, it was a very famous gymnasium.
Flutist Martha Rodriguez Salazar, clarinetist Rachel Condry, pianist Jennifer Peringer, and cellist Jill Brindell. They will be performing at the upcoming concert, A Listening Quilt, Contemporary Chamber Music by Women Composers from North and South America. It's free, Sunday, March 25th at the Community Music Center in San Francisco at 4 o'clock. Thank you all so much for coming in. And that's it for Open Air. I'm Rose Aguilar, sitting in for David LaTulipe. Thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and board engineer Ashley Ann Krigbaum, who is celebrating her birthday today. Happy birthday, Ashley Ann, and thank you for listening.